Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Financial Services and E-Commerce Practice Group, was recorded on Wednesday, May 20th, 2015, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call, our monthly update on the CFPB. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, we're recording this call for use as a podcast in the future. We welcome back to our call repeat guests. I think this is the first time they're teaming up, though. The Honorable Wayne A. Abernathy, he's Executive Vice President for Financial Institutions Policy and Regulatory Affairs at the American Bankers Association. He's joined by Julius L. Lozier of Counsel at Winston & Strawn. Both are members of the Executive Committee of the Federalist Society's Financial Services Practice Group. As I mentioned, they're both return guests. We're very happy to have them here. They're going to talk about 10 or so items of interest that have developed in the past month at the CFPB. Mr. Abernathy is going to lead us off, but then they're going to flip back and forth covering various items. At the end of their presentations, we will welcome your calls, your questions. We'll let you know how to ask questions, but please do be ready with your questions, as we'll spend a fair amount of time dealing with those. With that, Mr. Abernathy, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Dean, and thank you to everybody for joining us in the call today as we're discussing the Consumer Bureau and what they've been up to for the past month and what others have been up to in relation to the Bureau. Again, my name is Wayne Abernathy. I'm Executive Vice President here at the American Bankers Association. Today I'm joined by Jerry Lozier of Counsel at Winston & Strawn, and I believe Jerry's joining us from Chicago today. Both of us are members of the Executive Committee of the Federalist Society's Financial Services Practice Group. Jerry leads our working group on the Consumer Bureau and does a meticulous job of keeping an excellent summary of what goes on in connection with the Bureau each month. And that was really the foundation for this teleform. This is the latest of what has now become a series in updates on the activities of the new Consumer Bureau. And I just don't see us coming to the end of that well yet. I think we will continue this series because there will be much to talk about. Since our last update last month, Jerry has put together 28 notable Bureau events and activities through May 11. Today we're going to focus on several, but certainly not all, of the most notable. And after we touch upon those, and just really to lay them on the table, we won't go into great detail on each of them, but to tee them up for further discussion, we'll then be happy to take your comments and to discuss these issues further, any questions or comments you might have. Or we're certainly happy to go into other discussion of items that we didn't mention, but that may be of particular interest to you, or which that you think others should take note of as well. So I'll lead off with the first item, and I want to discuss the latest developments in the Bureau's proposed new chat room, or you might call it their new financial gossip feature. The Bureau has been, for several months, been working on their proposal to publish on the Bureau's official website, unverified, unedited, narratives that customers may put on, don't even have to be a customer, just consumers can put on the website, various complaints that they have about financial services that they have received or whatever they want to get off their chest. The Bureau made it clear that they don't intend to edit the substance of the presentations. They're not going to verify whether the allegations are true or false. Their view is that the market of public opinion will operate to decide whether the information is correct or whether it's false, and then if you think that what's being put there might be erroneous, then you get your chance to talk as well. That, of course, doesn't apply quite to the same as the financial companies that might be the target of the complaints. I work closely with several thousand banks that are members of ABA. I'm not aware of any of them that would be really looking forward to wanting to get into an argument with any of its customers on the website with anybody. Either they're happy to have a conversation with them and resolve complaints, but to get into a very vocal, very public back and forth about the truths or errors or other kind of information in connection with complaints, not something any of the banks are eager to do, and we've made that point to the Bureau, but the Bureau basically feels, well, that's your choice. The Bureau does justify, in part, this proposal to start publishing the narratives by offering one protection. They do recognize that there is the possibility that people who look at these narratives from legitimate customers might be able to figure out who those customers are and violate the privacy of those individuals. I think it's one thing when perhaps you have someone on one of the private sector websites complaining about the quality of the toaster that they bought. That may or may not be attractive to folks who might want to probe into private information and use it for nefarious purposes. It's probably significantly different when someone's talking about his bank account or his securities or other types of financial service and talking about that in a very public way. The need to preserve the privacy of those individuals is probably very high, and the Bureau has recognized that. And the Bureau has promised in their descriptions of their new plan that they will scrub this information, not for its veracity, but they'll scrub it to make sure that there is no identifiable information so that no one can figure out the identity of the person issuing the complaint. And that includes the ability to put pieces together and try to identify the individual. And they say that they have developed very sophisticated, state-of-the-art processes to scrub that privacy information and have tested them to make sure that they're effective. Except that, recently at a meeting of the other ABA, the American Bar Association, a former general counsel of the Consumer Bureau said, ain't nothing like that going on at all. He pointed out, so far as he knows, and he until recently was working there, he's not aware that the Bureau has done anything to test their procedures for scrubbing the privacy or personal information of the complainants. Given that revelation at the Bar Association, ABA just recently submitted a Freedom of Information Act request to the Bureau asking for public disclosure of the results of their testing, of their scrubbing efforts to make sure that they're very workable. Because if they're not workable, then the Bureau potentially could be luring complaining customers into some very dangerous kinds of situations and could be creating some very serious problems. So far, we have not heard back directly, although they have engaged with us about the terms and conditions of our request, and hopefully we'll be able to get information that we need. So that's what I'll say about that in the moment. Now I'd like to turn to Jerry. And Jerry, why don't you talk to us about credit card agreements and information given to the Bureau?
Sure. Thank you, Wayne. And actually, I'm going to mention two developments before handing the baton back to you. On credit card agreements, this is just a small item to that exemplifies sort of the regulatory burden that the CFPB imposes and the scope of that burden. Many may not realize that the CFPB requires all credit card issuers to file with the CFPB every quarter copies of their forms of credit card agreements. And so last April 15th, the CFPB adopted a final rule governing how those agreements are to be submitted. And to be fair to the CFPB, their intent here is to streamline the process and make it somewhat less burdensome. But so they're suspending the filing obligation for 1 year while they work out streamlined procedures to make it easier. In the meantime, the CFPB staff will manually apparently go to the websites of the largest card issuers and take down copies of the credit card agreements that are by law have to be posted on those websites and then transfer them to the CFPB website. But to give you a feel for how burdensome this is, there are apparently almost 450 credit card issuers that have been filing their forms of credit card agreements with the CFPB every quarter. The other item I just want to touch on, another small thing, but it sort of exemplifies everyone's tax dollars at work. On May 7th and 8th, the CFPB held its first research conference, and I think people who are listening might be interested in some of the items on the agenda. There was a panel on shocks and consumer well-being. There was a panel on consumer learning and behavior change, which considered a paper entitled, quote, Small Victories, : creating intrinsic motivation in task completion with an application to debt repayment, unquote. There was a panel on consumer background, knowledge, and expectations on financial outcomes. And lastly, there was a panel on information and consumer decision making, which considered a paper entitled Unshrouding Effects on Demand for a Costly Add-on, Evidence from Bank Overdraft in Turkey, unquote. So, Wayne, this is what we have been paying for. You should maybe, Wayne, if you are, will talk about CFPB funding.
Yes, that's a very good segue to that. I appreciate that, Jerry. The Bureau, interestingly, has, and to no surprise to many people, had various regulations that have a significant impact on small businesses. So Congress looked at a bill, H.R. 1195, that was put forward that would require the Bureau to create a Small Business Advisory Council. Now, under current law, the Bureau is required to consult and establish a small business panel only on a temporary basis, looking at certain types of regulations when, in their view, might have a significant impact on small businesses. But those are temporary panels. This proposal would have them create this advisory council that would be in place on an ongoing basis. The Congress, in putting forward the bill, ran a budget number on it, which they need to do with all legislation, see if there's a budgetary impact. And the Congressional Budget Office did find that there was a small impact, about $9 million over a 10-year period. And the authors of the legislation realized, well, in order to have this council, we got to find a way to pay for it. And the way they chose to pay for it was to reduce the money eligible for the Bureau's appropriations or funding over that 10-year period by $9 million. That's not a significant amount of money, but nevertheless, on April 21, the Office of Management and Budget threatened a veto from the President if that cut in the Bureau's budget were to go forward in the legislation. A brief reminder on how the Bureau is funded. The Bureau is not funded by appropriations. It's not funded by fees. The Bureau sets its budget, whatever it feels it needs to spend in any particular year, and they go to the Federal Reserve, and they say, this is how much money we need, and the Federal Reserve has to give it to them. I guess about the only question the Federal Reserve can ask is, do you want that in 10s and 20s? But the Federal Reserve cannot make any determination as to whether or not to give the funds. They have to provide the funds. This provision of the bill would have said, well, whatever they can ask for, it's $9 million less than what they can ask for, so those funds can be used to fund the Small Business Advisory Council. That legislation is still pending, and the presidential veto threat is still pending. We'll see how that develops as time goes by. Now let's go back to Jerry and talk to us about Bureau's investigations and how they're moving forward there.
Thank you, Wayne. On April 22nd, the American Banker newspaper published a story entitled Backlog Forces CFPB to Slow Down New Investigations. And the article cited a number of current and former CFPB officials off the record who acknowledged that there apparently has been a slowdown in the startup of new investigations at the CFPB. Apparently, the CFPB, when it opened in 2011, had transferred to it ongoing investigations that were being conducted by the various banking agencies in the area of consumer protection. And so it started running immediately, hit the ground running, you might say. Apparently, there's a statute called the Government Performance and Results Act that requires agencies to report to Congress on any investigations that are outstanding for more than 2 years. And apparently that has creates an incentive for these agencies to close investigations. And the CFPB apparently has the number of supervision activities, they call them, has dropped from 160 to 127 in fiscal 2014. Which is a drop of more than 20%. But nonetheless, the CFPB still has more than 100 investigations open reportedly. And I think Wayne is going to talk about one of those, the results of one of those investigations.
Thank you, Jerry. Is one of those investigations did come to a conclusion on April 28th. The Bureau announced an enforcement action, an agreement to settle the action, with Regions Bank with regard to overdraft fees. This would be debit overdraft programs. You might recall that when the Bureau was first up and running, high on its list of actions to take was to create regulations governing the debit card overdraft programs that nearly every bank offers to their debit card customers. Those regulations still remain to be proposed, but nevertheless, the Bureau is going forward with enforcement actions. In the case of the Regions Bank enforcement action, the Bureau held that the bank had been charging overdraft fees to customers that had not consented to have overdraft services. And under regulations that were created by the Federal Reserve prior to the creation of the Bureau, the banks are not allowed to charge any fees on overdrafts for any customers that have not affirmatively chosen to have overdraft programs. According to the agreement, the bank collected over a period of a couple of years $49 million in charges that had not been authorized by customers, which the bank has since refunded to its customers. In addition, the Bureau assessed a penalty of $7.5 million to Regions for this violation. This seems to be a straightforward application of the particular rules that were in effect at the time. They don't give us, at this point, any particular guidance or clue or indication of what the proposed changes the Bureau might be offering to these overdraft rules. But that was still a very significant case, and we wanted to bring it to your attention. Perhaps what's most significant in my mind, and we find this with a number of the enforcement actions that the Bureau takes, is that for the size of the infraction that the Bureau alleges, the penalty seems to be rather small, which suggests either that the Bureau is getting soft, or perhaps they're not as sure of their case, and that was the clearing, that was the price for clearing the enforcement action away and the bank to be able to get back on with its business and get that matter off its docket. That's just a guess on my part, but it's perhaps there's something to that. Anyway, let's move to Jerry to talk about a case in the D.C. Circuit, the Morgan Drexen case.
Yes. Thank you, Wayne. Morgan Drexen is or was a debt relief support service company. In July of 2013, Morgan Drexen, which found itself to be the target of a CFPB investigation, filed a lawsuit in the U.S. District Court in the District of Columbia, challenging the constitutionality of the establishment of the CFPB. It argued that it violated the separation of powers principles in the Constitution because the CFPB was delegated broad powers. It has a single director who's removable only for cause, and it is funded outside the normal appropriations process, as Wayne explained before. Within 30 days of the Morgan Drexen filing that lawsuit, the CFPB filed a litigation in an enforcement action in California against Morgan Drexen, accusing it of receiving illegal upfront fees for providing debt relief services. And so the U.S. District Court in the District of Columbia dismissed the initial case filed by Morgan Drexen on the basis that since Morgan Drexen was looking for an injunctive relief, it had another remedy, i.e. to defend itself in the California case. On May 1 last month, the D.C. Circuit upheld the dismissal by the district court. And one of our colleagues on the Federal Society Financial Services Practice Group board, executive committee, Professor Todd Zawicki, advised me recently that on May 2nd, the day after the D.C. Circuit decision came down, Morgan Drexen filed for bankruptcy, which is sort of the ending, sad ending of that story. Wayne, I'll turn it back to you to talk about credit reporting.
Okay. Yes, thank you very much, Jerry. The Bureau's on the prowl for constant looking for issues that need their constant care and their involvement. And one that they have recently found on May 5 in a report that they published is, in their view, and according to the report, 26 million people in the United States, one in every 10 adults, has no reported credit history. 19 million, or 8% of Americans, have credit history, but their records are insufficient to give them a credit score. The Bureau believes that's a problem. They call these people credit invisible, and they see this as a problem that needs to be addressed. They don't give any indications yet at this point how they would propose to address this particular problem, but they put it on the table, and I think to see what kind of concerns, what kind of echoes there might be with the concerns that they're raising in their report. Stay tuned to see what kind of solutions the Bureau may be proposing to address this problem that their study has identified. Now back to Jerry for another enforcement action.
Thank you, Wayne. And actually, I'm going to just mention two items briefly. One is the background on this particular enforcement action is, remember that the Dodd-Frank Act, I believe, exempts law firms from regulation by the CFPB. Nonetheless, on May 5th, the CFPB settled an enforcement action against the owner of a Florida law firm, which, according to the CFPB, had collected more than $5 million in fees by recruiting homeowners who were underwater into so-called mass joinder lawsuits against mortgage lenders. Apparently, the firm had recruited 1,200 such homeowners who each paid $6,000 to the law firm, and then were paying $495 a month to be part of the lawsuits. But apparently, many of these lawsuits were dismissed once they were eventually filed. The owner agreed to an $11.7 million suspended judgment, which apparently ended the case. So that's sort of an interesting development, because that could have been fought on the basis that the CFPB has no jurisdiction over law firms. The other item, Wayne, is a news story in the Automotive News publication. People may know that this, one of the CFPB's top priorities is auto lending. The CFPB is very concerned that when auto dealers negotiate loans and negotiate the interest rates on loans to buy cars and are compensated based on the amount of that interest rate, according to the CFPB, unlawful discrimination results. And so the Automotive News publication read a report that the CFPB issued on April 27th, which was a so-called snapshot of complaints by service members. And of 29,500 complaints by service members, less than 5% had to do with auto loans. But nonetheless, the report that was issued highlighted the enforcement actions that the CFPB was taking in that auto loan area. So the Automotive News thought there was a certain irony there. Wayne, I will turn it back to you.
Wayne Abernathy, are you there for your next round?
If not, I know something that Wayne was going to say.
Okay, Jerry, why don't you suggest to Wayne that he might have muted his phone.
I did, and I've just unmuted it.
Okay.
Okay, good.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Dean and Jerry. Appreciate that. One last item, actually, before we go to questions from our callers. This is, though, a group participation. I'd like to have anybody who's listening raise your hand if you still get your tax refund by mail rather than electronically. And if you get it by mail, the reason why I'm asking is you may have noticed, along with your refund check, was a little statement stuffer on behalf of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. And the text is very simple. It says as follows. It starts with a story. Everyone has a story about money. See people's stories and share yours. Get answers to money questions. The CFPB is working for you. And then there's a place where you can go and click and go and read their stories. Now you might wonder, what is that all about? Oh, and by the way, it's in Spanish on the backside. Todo comienza con una historia. And they go on and give you the same message in Espanol. And you might wonder, well, what is that all about? It seems from various sources that we can identify, the Bureau is getting nervous that not enough people in the country really care about them, are even aware of them, or care of their existence. And yet you might recall the existence of the Consumer Bureau, the creation of the Consumer Bureau, was one of the things most loudly trumpeted by the Obama administration in connection with the Dodd-Frank Act. Usually, if you're not getting enough foot traffic into your store, you engage in advertising. And that's what the Bureau is doing, to try to get more foot traffic, if you will, electronic foot traffic, to their website. And they're advertising the opportunity to come to their chat room, where you can share your story about money, read other people's stories about money, and maybe get answers to some money questions. They want to get in the financial advising business, I presume, but particularly the Bureau is interested in foot traffic to its website. Been there, done that. I can understand why they don't get much continued foot traffic, but nevertheless, we found that pretty curious. The remaining question is, who paid for that statement stuffer? Was it paid by the IRS, or was it paid by the Bureau? Now, if it's paid by the Bureau, do they have enough money to put in these little statement stuffers, but not enough money to pay for a small business consultative group at the Bureau? Apparently so. With that, those are, like I said, we were going to hit highlights going forward from here. We're now ready for any questions, comments from those of you who have been listening in on these issues or others that we might not have touched on.
Well, thank you very much, gentlemen. Let's turn to the audience now. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for either of our experts or both, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Our lines are wide open at this point. We don't have any questions pending. Let me get the ball rolling here by asking, I don't know, it might be a dumb question. I'm not sure. The CFPB, of course, was created, it was, as we just heard, by Dodd-Frank. I thought I'd also heard that under Dodd-Frank, the auto industry got a carve-out, sort of an exemption. They have a pretty, I guess, strong lobby. They were able to get themselves exempted from Dodd-Frank. Yet you're saying now that the CFPB, created by Dodd-Frank, as I understand it, is regulating or policing auto loans. How do those things get reconciled, if I'm right in my premise, anyhow?
Jerry, you want to take that on?
Yes, I do, and you'll have to restrain me. First of all, yes, Dean, you heard right. Yeah, the Dodd-Frank Act exempts auto dealers from regulation by the CFPB. But the CFPB asserts, and I have to begrudgingly say I think they're right, that they do have jurisdiction over firms that make loans to purchasers of automobiles, auto lenders. And they have, they are not, they would say they are not asserting jurisdiction over the auto dealers themselves. They're asserting jurisdiction over those so-called indirect lenders on whose behalf the auto dealers may be working. So that, and going on and on about that, just two other quick points. Senator Elizabeth Warren reportedly in the last few days has said that she will fight to remove the exemption for auto dealers from the Dodd-Frank Act. And the other thing, and I bet Wayne is going to want to jump in on this, some of my colleagues believe that the CFPB knows no boundaries in what it wants to regulate, and just recently that was evidenced by its settlement with two of the telecommunications companies that it resolved something like $150 million in fines for, quote, cramming, unquote. So CFPB's jurisdiction really knows no bounds, even if there are statutory exemptions.
Now, Jerry, I want to take you back a step with that. You said that Elizabeth Warren has announced that she would like to make an amendment to the Dodd-Frank Act. Have we found an element of the Dodd-Frank Act that she believes is not perfect?
That's right. This is the one amendment she will not fight, apparently.
Well, there's something to be said for that. So maybe there's an opening there to reform the reforms.
Yes.
Once again, if you're among our audience members and you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We've got plenty of time for questions, and our lines are completely open with no questions pending. Let me ask a second question of our two experts then, and that is, we've been doing these calls for some time now. I'm not quite sure how long we've been doing these monthly updates on CFPB activity. Is this a particularly active month for the CFPB, a slow month? That's one question. And the second part of the question is, do you, having engaged in these calls and monitoring the CFPB for some time now, do you see any trends emerging? Now, I was interested to hear, and I think Wayne's remarks, that one action of the CFPB might be interpreted as them not being as aggressive or softening, at least in one particular area, and there was some conjecture in that statement. But so the second part of the question is, are there trends you've been able to identify in CFPB's activities?
Well, Jerry, let me take a stab at that first, and you may have some ideas as well. One trend that I have seen, Dean, and I assumed when I initially saw this that it had to do with the fact that the Bureau at the time wasn't led by someone who had been confirmed by the Senate. This was before Richard Cordray had actually been confirmed by the Senate in a legitimate way rather than the what's clearly the illegal presidential appointment that he got, that skipped the Senate. And that was, it seemed, at least up until that point, the Bureau was very shy of going to court, particularly in a contentious kind of situation. Since then, I assumed, well, okay, now maybe they'll be willing to be more aggressive. But I've noticed the trend remains. Nearly every enforcement action that the Bureau engages in, they do it together with another regulator. When they take an action against a bank, usually at the same time, there's a joined action by one of the bank regulators. Recent actions taken against Sprint and some of the phone companies have been done together with the FCC. And I've wondered, and I certainly don't know the answer to it, but I've wondered if they do that because they're a little bit nervous of being exposed in a potential court case where the very jurisdiction of the Bureau and its constitutionality might be a potential issue raised in the case. I don't know. Jerry, you have any thoughts on that?
I admire, Wayne, how closely you observe what they're doing and how closely you analyze it. No, I don't. The trends that I see actually are something that I've heard repeatedly articulated by Director Cordray and other senior people there, and it's sort of a substantive observation, and that is those of us who believe in the free market, even we have to acknowledge there are certain elements in the consumer financial arena that do not have market forces operating on how they treat consumers. And for example, servicers, you know, are selected by the creditors and contract with creditors. So theoretically, market forces do not require them to treat consumers well. Same with credit reporting agencies. You know, their contractual obligations are with lenders, not with the consumers. And so they are, in the view of the CFPB, they are not responsive to consumer concerns. And thirdly, collection agencies, again, are hired by creditors, not by consumers. And so, again, they have no market-based incentive to treat consumers well. And you see that, I think, driving the very tough, hostile, adversarial approach that the CFPB has, especially to servicers, which, you know, it's gone after mortgage servicers. It now seems to be going after student loan servicers. And they're going to be promulgating collection agency regulations. And I guess I'm sure they're tough on credit reporting agencies, but that is sort of a trend that I have observed. It's not creative on my part to detect it. Director Cordray has mentioned this a couple of times, at least in speeches.
Once again, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've got an unusually read as an audience, gentlemen. I want to return, if I could, to the complaint letters that we mentioned at the outset. I think Wayne Abernathy, you mentioned them. How many of the complaint letters they receive are they and forgive me if you mentioned this, but how many are they posting? How are they selecting the ones they post? Are they doing any sort of screening at all to make sure there's any basis in fact for any of these letters? And is this the kind of, let me end the question there.
Well, those are all very important questions, Dean. And right now, they're not posting the narratives of the complaints. They're currently posting numbers with regard to complaints, how many complaints they're having of this type and of that type, and for which banks and other entities. And they publish those data, and then they do some aggregating periodically. What they are planning to do is expand it to actually include the text of the narratives, not just I've got a complaint with X bank about how they handled my deposit account and how
and
much
is that is that 100% of the complaints?
The narratives would be, I think, a share, because you can choose whether you have to actually affirmatively say I want to have my narrative published.
Right.
And you can say, I don't want to. Now, they haven't done that yet. This is a proposal that they have out there. It is right now being hotly debated. There are various suggestions that have been made as to how to resolve some of the problems. But the points that you raise are ones that that are really at the crux of the debate, which is they propose to publish these narratives without any evaluation of the veracity at all. They admit that, but they admit that without including another disclaimer, or at least they don't plan to include a disclaimer, so that when you go to the website and actually look at these complaints, there's nothing there to tell you that these are unvarnished, these are unverified, they may or may not be accurate. There's nothing in that regard at all. And the concern is that when someone goes to a website like the Bureau's, which has at the top of its website an official website of the United States government, that this information must be true, because we have a government agency that's publishing it. And that's, I think, a very serious problem.
Mm-hmm. Jerry Loza, were you going to say anything on this point?
Yeah, I was just going to say, as Wayne said, the CFPB will give the consumer an option whether to let it publish. So there'll be an opt-in process. The only verification the CFPB says it will do is to verify that there actually is a relationship between the complainant and the consumer service provider. So I guess they ask the complaint about company to verify is this that person actually a customer, but that is it. So it's really very, very concerning. The American Bankers Association has sent a letter to the CFPB, drawing an analogy to the Consumer Product Safety Commission, which apparently publishes consumer complaint letters, but only after the Consumer Product Safety Commission verifies the accuracy of what's in the letter. So the ABA has asked the CFPB why couldn't you adopt a similar process where you verify this before you publish it?
Right.
And from a consumer point of view, that the reason why that makes sense is if the purpose of publishing the complaint narratives is to provide consumers with better information that will help them make decisions and choices and so forth, it seems to me it's incumbent upon you to make sure that you're providing them accurate information. Otherwise, you could be very much misleading customers, driving them away from what actually might be good sources of financial services or otherwise causing problems that are not based upon truth.
Mm-hmm. Are these narratives going to include, and we do have a couple questions in the audience now, so we'll go to those next, but would they include statements praising different institutions? I mean, mm-hmm. is it just as likely or just as possible that somebody's going to flood the bulletin board or whatever we're calling this with positive comments that would be of equally dubious or unverified value, I'd say?
Well, yes, that is correct, Dean. Someone under their proposal could have a narrative that says, I really love my institution because of X, Y, or Z. And, of course, the Bureau will not be verifying that either.
Right.
So potentially that is going to be there. But I don't know too many people, and I'm certainly not one of them, who, when satisfied with the services that I'm paying for, whether it's my bank or it's anyone else, to say, I want to go on a website, a government website, and I want to tell them what a great job my financial service provider is doing. Mm-hmm. I don't know that there would be many of those.
It seems it would have all the value of just any public discussion board, but this has the misleading characteristic of having the aegis of the federal government on it, I guess.
Right. That's the problem.
Dean, I should insert, though, in fairness to the CFPB, that the CFPB, when it did adopt this policy, final policy statement on this, it did say that it will explore ways to publish positive feedback or to encourage positive feedback about consumer financial service providers. I think that's going to be kind of, that seems sort of ethereal to me, but they explicitly did say that, and I think they're trying to take some steps to do that, but I don't know how that really could be very effective.
Well, let's turn now to the audience. We've got a couple questions pending. If you'd like to join the queue, we still have some time. Push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Let's take our first call today.
Yes, hello. This is Bob Davis in Maine. The Bureau was purposely put outside the control of Congress. Is there any concern on the part of anybody with putting it under the control of Congress? And if that were to be desired, how would it be done? Is there a mechanism that would accomplish that?
Jerry, you want to take that one?
Oh, sure. Yes, it is outside the control of Congress. There have been repeated congressional efforts, Republican congressional efforts, to bring the CFPB into the ordinary congressional appropriations process. Those bills also would provide for a bipartisan commission to operate the CFPB instead of just a single director. And Wayne may know some of the other provisions of those bills. Those bills, of course, they may pass the House, but they've not passed the Senate. They may pass this year. Some of us have speculated that there will be something like that will pass Congress this year, but I think everyone expects the president to veto any such legislation, unfortunately, because he feels that the CFPB should be independent of political pressure, I suppose, and that kind of thing. So, but Wayne, you're closer to this than I am, being in Washington.
Well, I would say, Jerry, and those are the two leading proposals, and those are not novel. That is the same approach that's taken to make sure that there's adequate accountability for the Securities and Exchange Commission, mm-hmm. and as well as for the FTC. So that's the normal way for regulators, that you make them subject to the appropriations process, which doesn't mean so much that you play around with their budget, but it means that they have to come before Congress and be accountable for what they're doing and have to explain themselves and explain their actions. I don't know many cases, and I worked at the Senate for over 20 years. I don't know many cases where budgets were actually cut because Congress was annoyed at this or that or other practice that an agency was doing. But I do know that they would hold them accountable, bring them before the Congress, and have them explain their particular actions. And yet right now, the Bureau doesn't have to do that.
Isn't it totally irresponsible on the part of Congress to create an agency over which they have no control whatsoever? Is that even legal?
Well, that's the question. I'm not sure that it's constitutional. It seems to me that there is certainly no set of checks and balances, no accountability, and I don't know how that can survive in a system of government whose founding document says we the people. There's no we the people connection with the Bureau and what it does. And not only is it insulated from Congress, but it's made a Bureau of a government agency that's already being accused of being too insulated from government, the Federal Reserve. And that was not accidental. In looking for ways to insulate the Bureau from accountability, not only did they say you've got your own budget and you got your one director and you don't have these other forms of checks and balances, but we're going to embed you in the Federal Reserve, which already has a significant number of barriers to public accountability.
So we must simply get used to having the king's prerogative everywhere in the government and totally destroy the check and balance system that at least once existed?
It feels that way when you are going up against the Bureau, when they have a regulation that's proposed. It feels like you're petitioning the king to say, well, we think it has this problem, that problem. We really, really hope that you'll fix it.
All right, thank you.
Thank you. Good questions.
Once again, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've got one question pending, and then our lines are wide open. Jerry Lozier, I didn't mean to cut you off. Did you have something you want to say on this point?
Dean, I was just going to mention to Bob, Davis in Maine, that this Morgan Drexen case that I described raised those exact issues, and it was dismissed on procedural grounds, you know, standing essentially. So those issues still are legitimate. His concern about, is it irresponsible to do that? It may be unconstitutional to have created an agency that's outside the process, the appropriations process, and whose leader cannot be removed except for cause, et cetera, et cetera. So there may be a remedy in the courts eventually, if someone can ever get standing, and if someone's willing to stand up and fight the CFPB and raise that issue.
And I would add, Jerry, I think, and it's my own belief, that that lies behind the reason why the Bureau is somewhat gun-shy about taking on enforcement cases that are hotly contested for fear that those issues might be raised in a court case.
Let's go to our next caller. Looks like someone from Washington, D.C. on the line here.
Hi, gentlemen. This is Tony Cotto with the NAIC. I'm sure you saw that Banking Committee Chairman Shelby released a discussion draft. You've got 219 pages of Dodd-Frank tweaks and fixes, and almost none of them touch the CFPB aside from the qualified mortgage rule and subjecting them to the Federal Advisory Committee Act. I'm wondering if you read anything into this. Do you think there might be a separate bill to just deal with the CFPB? Sort of what's your take on why there weren't more fixes given how public some of the problems have been?
Well, Senator Shelby, who put together this bill, chairman of the Senate Banking Committee, made it very clear he was trying to create a bill that he believed Republicans and Democrats could get behind. And so he intentionally tried to stay away from the highly controversial issues. And the Democrats consider anything that changes the structure of the Bureau to be off limits, at least at this time, and they're not interested in any kind of amendments, and that would have driven them away from participating in the bill. Unfortunately, as things went forward, at least in at the current stage, Democrats aren't enamored even of the provisions that Senator Shelby has put forward. But I don't think it's an indication of a desire on the part of Chairman Shelby and others to entertain amendments and adjustments and correcting some of these accountability issues with the Bureau. I think it's their recognition that that would be a topic for subsequent legislation. But for this current first piece of legislation that the Senate has taken up in years, since Dodd-Frank, as a matter of fact, to try to reform some of the reforms, they wanted to try to make it as bipartisan as possible.
Good question, though.
Yeah. And hopefully we will see some other things. There are certainly – I particularly believe that were we to have a lame duck session of Congress after the next presidential election, and if that presidential election elected a Republican to be president, that all of a sudden Democrats might think that creating more accountability for the Bureau might be a good idea.
Again, if you have a question, you'd like to join the conversation, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. Wayne and Jerry, you and your colleagues on the Executive Committee of the Financial Services Practice Group co-authored a paper suggesting some aspects of Dodd-Frank that were ripe for change. Did many of those address the CFPB, or can you say more about that? And this is a paper, by the way, it's available on the Federal Society's website.
Yeah, thanks, Dean, for pointing to that. Yeah, we have about it's about a 10-page document, and a little more than one of the pages is devoted to changes to the Bureau. That document is not an effort to be partisan or whatever. It's a nonpartisan effort. We were just trying to look at what kind of changes made sense and question it from the point of view of policy and accountability. And some of those changes we recommend are the ones that Jerry has mentioned and that others have mentioned to try to improve the accountability and the operations of the Bureau. We don't go so far in that paper of suggesting eliminating the Bureau. We were looking at things that we thought were doable, even though they might require some significant changes in policy direction that had been taken under Dodd-Frank. They seem to us the kinds of things that Republicans and Democrats over time, such as accountability of agencies, have supported and could support. And a couple of things that we've mentioned here are things that are in that recommendation. And we certainly do encourage you to go and look at that document for not only our recommended changes for the Bureau, but also some that we do for some of the other Dodd-Frank provisions. And this is an effort really to start a debate and to start a discussion. It's not a lobbying piece. It's an idea of putting out on the table some ideas that might make the actual implementation of Dodd-Frank more effective and to increase the debate and discussion on how to do that.
Let me make a final call for questions here. If you want to ask a question, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone while we're waiting to see if somebody rings in. I'll make the typical commercial announcement. Our next scheduled Teleform conference call is Friday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. It's a Teleform on immigration law and policy with the Honorable Linda Chavez, who is now chairman of the Center for Equal Opportunity, and former congressman, the Honorable Tom Tancredo, who's now co-chairman of Team America PAC and president of the Rocky Mountain Foundation. That is Friday at 1 p.m. I don't see any final questions. Gentlemen, do you each want to take a minute or so to wrap up?
Jerry, you want to go ahead?
I guess the only thing I have to say is I thought this last month was a fairly slow month at the CFPB. I didn't see that much earth-shaking coming out of the CFPB in the last 30 days. So I think we were lucky that it's quieted down a little bit because it could do a lot more if it wanted to, I think.
And I would just add, Dean, I think that Jerry's wishes are unlikely to be met. Because since May 11, which is the end point of Jerry's collection of 28 items, there have been some significant new developments in connection with the Bureau, not the least of which is a proposal in connection with this legislation that's before the Senate Banking Committee to allow the Bureau to write rules and enforce the Servicemen's Relief Act, which governs how financial services are provided to service members and their families. That could be a very interesting topic that we'll raise in the next edition of this call.
Well, gentlemen, it's Dean Reuter again. Thank you so much for your time, as always. I was advised during the call that this is the ninth such call we've had, so we're developing quite a track record, so we'll come up on the 12th and 1 year mark here. But we certainly appreciate your time, and it takes a lot of effort to put these reports together. We appreciate that of you, Jerry, and you, Wayne, for joining the call as well. Our audience, of course, we appreciate you joining in as well and your thoughtful questions. A reminder to join us for our next scheduled Teleform call, but also to visit the website for other calls that are being added as the Supreme Court continues to resolve cases. That next call, scheduled call, is 1 p.m. Friday Eastern Time. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.